This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good afternoon, good evening, America, good morning, Australia, or whatever your time zone across this beautiful planet Earth of ours. You are tuned into the People Who Speak radio show with Steve Johnson. The People Who Speak show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. Anyone can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have our virtual radio room, the People Who Speak radio show. This is a fantastic show tonight. I'm more excited than Donald Trump getting a new toupee. We have an amazing guest right here. He's been a personal work associate of mine for nearly 10 years. He's a former U.S. Marine and Marine investigator and the former senior editor of the Jakarta Post. He was one of the first people on the scene of the 2002 Bali bombings in Kuta, Bali at the Sari Club, and has subsequently been pursuing exposure of this truth ever since. We're talking tonight to Mr. Robert S. Finnegan about the sheer impossibility of the official story of the Sari Club bombing and his experiences in trying to get that truth out. Welcome to the People Speak show, Bob Finnegan, sir.
Good evening, Steve. How are you out there?
Fantastic. You know, we'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you, Bob, is how did you initially get the position of the senior editor of the largest English-speaking newspaper in Indonesia?
Well, they approached me in 2001, and we went through a long vetting process, approximately 6 months, and the Jakarta Post was making a transition into the new democracy here in Indonesia, and they were searching for an American editor to bring in American-style newspaper reporting, especially investigative reporting, into their paper to fall into line with the new democracy and the new press laws here in Indonesia. So they employed me in 2001. Basically as a Sunday editor to start with, and then I transitioned into a newsroom editor with emphasis on teaching the first group of investigative journalists here under the new democracy in Indonesia. So I was assigned six bright young college students, and they were placed under my care, and we proceeded to train them to be investigative reporters. And right about that time, approximately a month into their training, the Bali bombing occurred.
Now, you uncovered that a lot of the explosive material from the Sari site in Kuta, Bali was in fact military and special forces type explosives. Is this even remotely possible that the three blamed Indonesians could have got hold of these and done this attack?
Let me start from the beginning. When I first walked onto the site, it was dark. I was progressing down Jalan Legian when I began to encounter the broken glass and the downed wires, and I thought to myself, well, okay, it's going to be right up the road here, a block or two. Five blocks later, I was still progressing into the primary blast zone with the damage becoming even more intense. The next morning, when I walked on the site and in the daylight, and I could get a real grip of the extent of the damage, I was basically in shock. You know, being a Marine, I've blown up a lot of stuff in my time, and I recall thinking that I had never seen damage like this. We had concrete that was stripped from rebar approximately 100 feet from the crater of the second blast in front of the Sari Club. And my subsequent education as far as forensic explosives revealed that that would require 1.5 million pounds per square inch.
Wow.
To strip that concrete off that rebar. And I just couldn't, I couldn't imagine any type of conventional explosive that I had ever dealt with or seen that, that could cause that type of damage. And that's in that kind of an area. I mean, the secondary blast zone was probably a square block that was all but flattened. And, you know, that the damage to the surrounding buildings was just incredible. I mean, you couldn't even imagine. I was thinking possibly, you know, a semi truck, you know, filled with C4, and even that wouldn't have caused the extent of the damage that I was seeing. So right out of the gate, we were wondering. If there was a possibility that this was not conventional explosives. And over the course of our investigation, we eventually wound up coming to the conclusion that something was seriously wrong with the conclusions of the international investigating team and their contention that this was some type of ANFO or chlorate or, they came out with every type of explosive in the book day after day. As I said in my analysis, it was something different. And they finally located the one of the parts for the Mitsubishi van that was stamped with the serial numbers that allowed them to go back and finger Ambrosi as one of the individuals that was involved in this bombing. But
right.
When I ran this scenario, I was working fortunately, I'd contacted Best in Chemical Corporation in America because I was completely in the dark. I had absolutely no forensic explosive experience, and I wanted to ask them about the explosive yield of these different compounds that the international investigating team was putting forth. And so they were very cooperative and very helpful. And their conclusion at the end, when I spoke to one of their engineers, was that his words were, we can't account for this using conventional explosives. That I shipped them some of the forensic images of the blast damage at the Sari Club. And they came back and they said, we don't have any idea what this could have been. You know, especially when it came to the concrete that was stripped off the rebar on a building across the street from the Sari Club.
Yeah, that would take an overpressure that just wasn't even possible with what they claimed from the official story.
Right, so they're the ones that gave me the 1.5 million pounds per square inch number, and they said that we just can't account for this. We have no idea what could have caused this. So they didn't make any speculation about what type of device it was, but they were pretty much solid in their contention that it didn't look like conventional explosives whatsoever.
So my question still remains, is it even remotely possible that the three blamed Indonesians could have got hold of this material and done an attack of that extent and that damage?
Highly doubtful.
Right.
I don't see how. You know, you have Ambrosi, who I believe he had a seventh or eighth grade education, and he was a motorcycle mechanic in Central Java in a small village. How in the world this man could have ever come into possession of this type of device with that kind of explosive yield is impossible. It's just beyond the realm of possibility. I don't know how he could have done it.
I doubt that there's anybody living or breathing on this planet that knows as much about the Bali bombings as you do, Mr. Bob Finnegan, sir. So in your expert opinion about this topic and this subject, why would they do this? Or whoever did it, what was the outcome? What was the goal that they wanted?
Well, I believe that it was, you know, right about that time, George W. Bush was prosecuting the brand new war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was, his administration was recruiting countries that would participate as allies in their coalition. Now, he approached John Howard, who was then the Prime Minister of Australia at the time, and requested that he join the coalition, and Howard initially refused. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, we have the Bali bombing, and shortly after that, John Howard joined the war on terror, joined the coalition. So it's my belief that this bombing, you know, that they knew that there would be many Australians in Kuta. Kuta Beach is a vacation destination for Australia. So I would assume that they knew that there would be many Australian casualties, which would stoke public outrage against terror and terrorists, you know, Islamic terror and terrorists, and allow public opinion to be swayed into accepting, you know, becoming a part of this coalition that the United States put together.
I have heard you mention before in a previous interview I did many years ago, I think about 6-7 years ago, you mentioned that it was an attempt to clean up the Bali area, to clean up the Kuta beaches. Do you still contend with that?
That would have probably been something that was like a value-added facet to this. I don't think that it was one of the main reasons. Now, you got to remember that as time goes on, and we still get bits and pieces of information that come in, and I put that lower on the list now. You know, rather than I would say that the main cause was to bring Australia into the war on terror, you know, just by virtue of the Australian casualties.
Right,
that
right.
Were killed. Yeah.
Have you heard a lot of Bali truth from the actual Indonesians on the street there in Jakarta?
Oh yeah. Well, it's all speculation, but even now, even to this day, you can virtually get in any taxi cab in Jakarta and ask the taxi driver, "Who do you think was responsible for the Bali bombing?" And they will immediately say the CIA. So there's
wow.
There hasn't really been any concrete evidence submitted by the Indonesian population. I haven't had any evidence handed over by Indonesian citizens. But the general attitude here is that it was not Amrozi and Samudra that were the primary individuals responsible for this bombing, but they were patsies. Mm.
Yeah. When you began finding the evidence of military explosives and of the cover-up and the initial official story that was completely garbage, what kind of backlash did you experience in Indonesia, and from who did you get the backlash from?
Oh, my goodness. Initially, it was actually backlash that I sought out. The Indonesian National Police that I contacted were very hostile at my inquiries. I also received backlash from the U.S. Embassy and U.S. Ambassador Ralph Boyce when I asked him point blank, you know, was the U.S. involved in any way in this bombing? And his response was, you need to get on the team, Finnegan. And basically shut me down at the Jakarta Post. I found out from my students who are the true heroes in this entire fiasco. You got to remember that I was brand new in Indonesia. I didn't speak the language, and trying to adjust to working and living here alone was tough enough, but concurrently running a major investigation into a bombing, it would have been impossible if it hadn't been for my students. They held my hand, translated for me, brought me up to speed. The learning curve was straight up on Indonesian culture and traditions and how I could make inquiries and how I couldn't make inquiries, and basically ran interference for me besides being out there on the street themselves with almost no training whatsoever, gathering evidence and doing interviews for this investigation. So these young journalists are the unsung heroes of this bombing, because it never would have got off the ground if it hadn't been for them.
And, of course, there is one of your journalists who did an amazing job at the airport, at Nuwa Raya Airport in Bali. Can you mention him at all?
Absolutely. Damaso Reyes was instrumental in this investigation going forward with his acquisition of the tower and apron logs there at Nuwa Raya Airport. And this enabled us to identify three planes that apparently had flown out the bodies of five UN peacekeepers that were supposedly here on leave from East Timor, and they got caught up in the blast. Their bodies were transported to Sangalang Hospital and were subsequently taken by individuals in military uniforms that had no insignia, taken out to the closed Nuwa Raya Airport and flown out on a Dash 37 with bogus tail numbers. And this is what Damaso was going after when he acquired these tower and apron logs. And the people that were in charge of the airport at that time were so outraged that this had happened that he was able to secure these records, which enabled us to identify the one plane that we were looking for, and it was a Dash 7 out of Australia, out of Queensland, and sporting bogus tail numbers. And unfortunately, when it landed in Singapore to refuel, we lost it because the Singaporean authorities refused to cooperate with us in tracking it further.
So this plane was actually carrying bodies of UN troops in full uniform, five of them, who got caught setting off the blast at the Sari Club. Is that true?
No, they didn't. They didn't get caught setting it off. We believe that they were observers.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right. That,
that's what we believe. No, they weren't. They weren't involved, so to speak, with the blast itself. But we believe that they were placed there as observers. As a matter of fact, there were approximately 30 UN peacekeepers somehow on leave on that very day in Kuta when that bomb went off. You know, that we found that really odd.
Goodness. No, but, and some of the research I've done, Bob, would also suggest that there were 250 UN troops on the island of Bali doing exercises officially that night.
That was interesting also. So there's a possibility that it could have been a coincidence, but we doubted that seriously, just given the fact that there were actually five casualties there at that time. And the fact that they were removed forcibly from Sangla Hospital against the protests of the doctors and the authorities there. So there was some type of connection there that the UN obviously didn't want anyone to make. So, and Sangla Hospital at that time was chaotic, as you can imagine. It was not only trying to deal with the casualties, but it was also dealing with the families of the deceased and it was complete bedlam. There was no organization to speak of whatsoever. Some very courageous people, expatriates, doctors that were on Bali on vacation, and other expatriate doctors that were in Indonesia all flooded into Sanglah to assist with the casualties and the wounded. So there is another group of unsung heroes there that actually, their lives were impacted. I've spoken to several since then over the years, and they really never quite recovered from that experience emotionally. Yeah.
Now, you have been tireless in trying to get the truth out about Bali since it actually happened in 2002. What has your quest cost you personally? What does it cost you?
Well, first off, it cost me my career as a journalist, because I was summarily fired at Jakarta Post following the publication of my analysis. And basically blacklisted. So that was the end of my career. There isn't a day that goes by, Steve, that I don't think about this bombing. So the impact has been permanent, and it's going to remain permanent. It's a part of me. It's part of my life now.
And I'm sure turning up there on the night of the blast, that would have affected you and traumatized you. Is that true?
Well, to the extent that that I'd never, you know, fortunately, I with my Marine Corps background and our extensive training, I was prepared to operate in an environment like that. But I never imagined that I'd ever see anything like this. It was horrendous, and I'm sure that anyone that was there came away with the same type of mental scarring that comes with seeing, you know, 200 people plus just massacred, you know. And there was, like I said, at Sanglah, horrible injuries to the people, to the survivors, that I can remember them to this day, walking into the burn ward in the hospital and observing some of these poor people that had been burned, you know, over 80% of their body. And it was something that that never leaves you. It just never leaves.
And you know, talking about the burns, that's very, very interesting point. Dr. Fiona Stanley from Western Australia, a very expert in burns wards and burns cases, she actually said that these burns were like nothing she'd ever seen. Can you clarify that?
That's correct. There was one individual. They were, besides being absolutely overwhelmed, these doctors and nurses that I observed were so traumatized that they were very reluctant to speak to anyone, let alone a journalist. I did happen to corner one nurse that I observed breaking down in one of the hallways, and I managed to talk to her about what she'd seen, and that was her comment, that the only time she'd ever seen burns like this were in pictures of the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So they were traumatized, not only because of the injuries to their patients, but they were also traumatized because they had no idea what had caused these burns. Probably seen the one image that I took of one Indonesian national that had third-degree burns on his arms and his face and head. But the striking thing about this image was that the burns were clearly delineated by his shirt sleeves and his open neck collar.
Wow.
Meaning that he didn't receive burns where his shirt was covering his chest and torso, yet the exposed parts of his arms, his face, and his neck, he received third-degree burns. And the thing that really stood out was this man had third-degree burns completely on his face, but his hair was still intact. This always has been a question in our minds, how this man could have suffered third-degree burns on his face, and yet his hair was still there.
Yes, and his eyebrows were still intact.
Yeah, we actually missed that at first, and it was one of my journalism students that pointed that out, that he was still in possession of his hair, his facial hair, and the hair on his head. It was, the image is online in any event.
You've always asserted that, in fact, many people were vaporized by the Sari Club blast that were not included in the final dead tall figure. Can you confirm that is actually what happened?
Without a doubt. All one would have to do, pictures are pretty descriptive, but they don't tell the entire story. When you actually stand there and look at the crater, and especially given the 1,500 pounds of body parts that they collected, and they were never counted in the final death toll. They were never tabulated into the final death toll. It's our assumption that there were many more casualties than are listed as official.
What kind of blast could actually vaporize people, though? That's beyond my experience.
Well, I would assume that if there was actually a huge amount of plastic involved, that there would be some vaporization of individuals that were relatively close to the bomb itself, but. When you look at the crater itself, and you can imagine Kuta Legion, especially at that time at night, it's like Mardi Gras in New Orleans. It's just packed with people, shoulder to shoulder. So you can imagine that there were probably a fair amount of individuals that simply disappeared in the blast, and we're not accounted for. Yeah, there had to be. Like I said, I'm going back to the body parts again. There's 1,500 pounds of body parts that they had at Sanglah. That
God,
they were never able to identify. So, it's my belief that there were more casualties besides the official number that was released, and we'll never know. Kuta has a reputation for having a large transient population, so these individuals may have just disappeared and no inquiries were made in the aftermath. We'll never know.
The three stooges that they blamed, and I call them stooges because that's what they were, the three blamed and executed for the Sari Club attack were Imam Samudra, Ali Gufron, and Amrozi. Why do you think that they, who were clearly not behind the attack, and they clearly could not have the material nor expertise or ability to do such a thing, why do you think they admitted it?
That's going to be a mystery that will never be solved, because I can say that I watched the tape of them reenacting their role in the bombing. And one thing that was really striking was when they were taken out of the van, although, you know, given the considerable amount of damage, you know, you would expect there to be a small amount of confusion, but they seem to look like they didn't know, even know where they were, you know. And I think that, you know, watching them reenact, you know, the scenario leading up to the bombing, it just didn't look right. It looked like it was it could have possibly been coached. I have no idea, but it looked really strange to us. So, you know, that there's a possibility that that they were there and that the damage was so extensive that they couldn't identify the landmarks. But there was something that simply wasn't right about their performance in that reenactment, you know, and that could have been too that they were under a lot of pressure. The bottom line is we'll never know, but there was also something really strange about their actions and movements.
Their behavior, their body language, and their micro signals.
Yeah, everything. Everything, you know, about it. And one other thing that was striking about Amrozi was he was, for a guy that had just killed over 200 people, when he made his first court appearance, he was smiling and waving. You know, we can't account for that type of behavior. That's not normal behavior anyways, for not only for human beings, but especially for Indonesians. You know, I mean, there would have been at least some remorse knowing that, you know, he'd actually killed over 200 of his own countrymen, but he seemed to actually almost enjoy being in the limelight. And he wasn't known to be a sociopath or have sociopathic or psychological problems.
Right.
So
right.
His behavior in the courtroom was completely out of character for an individual, like I said, especially an Indonesian that had just murdered over 200 people. You know, so
well, please do stick with us. Mr. Finnegan, please do stick with us. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with very special guest, Mr. Bob Finnegan, live on Internet Radio. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak. Every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to the People Who Speak radio show, coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our very special guest. He's a former U.S. Marine and Marine investigator and the former Jakarta Post senior editor, who is now devoted to awakening the masses about the crimes in Bali 2002. Welcome back there, Rob Finnegan, sir.
Good evening.
Good to have you. It certainly is.
Thank you for having me, Steve. This is a rare opportunity to clear some of the air around this bombing.
I know you don't give interviews very often. I know it's very rare that you give interviews, so I'd like to thank you for coming here onto the People Speak radio show on the BBS radio network.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. This is an opportunity that I've been thinking about now for quite some time, because as you said, I haven't given interviews on this. So this is a first for me. So okay. In any event, go ahead.
We just have a question from Orangutan. Have you heard of Pat Tillman? What happened to him?
Peripherally, from sources in the military, I heard that Pat Tillman, after arriving in Afghanistan, began to question the United States' role in the occupation there. And this is pure speculation, but I heard talk of the possibility that he was actually killed in a friendly fire incident by his own unit. And now whether or not there was a lot of speculation as to whether or not this was a result of his questioning the U.S. role in Afghanistan. Nothing's been confirmed. There is no concrete evidence that this is in case fact. But that seems to be the opinion of a rather large group of military personnel, military veterans, that were peripherally involved in this. So it very well could have been an assassination.
Wow.
As far as anybody knows.
Okay, I've got a very serious question. It involves a retired Air Force colonel from the Indonesian Air Force that came into the Indonesian police office about a week after the bombings, crying, admitting he was involved in the Bali bombings, called Colonel Didi Mushrikan. Can you confirm that that actually happened?
It did happen. And when we learned about it, when our team learned about it, we started kicking over rocks and made every effort to locate the colonel, and he had vanished into thin air. And to this day, I still don't know. I still don't know his whereabouts, or if in fact he's still alive. You know, but there was something. There was something there, because this individual had absolutely no reason whatsoever to make that kind of a claim. Obviously, the colonel knew something about the bombing, but as I said, he vanished right after this claim was made.
And wow.
As a matter of fact, we made an extensive search. We made an extensive search from throughout Indonesia, not just on Java and Bali, but throughout Indonesia.
This was a member of the military who came forward admitting his involvement in the bombings. Wouldn't that make worldwide news?
One would think so, but the military, we came to the conclusion that the military was not involved, and that they were taken for a ride and guided down dead-end trails by the international investigation team, which included the Australian Federal Police and the FBI. So they were given basically, from what I could see, they were basically given busy work and sent off on false leads to distract them and keep them away from the blast site. Which,
right.
By the way, I'm sure you know that shortly after, it must have been only a week, they brought in bulldozers and shoveled up all the forensic evidence and dumped it in the trucks, transported it to Benoa Harbor and dumped it in the sea.
Yes, sir. Operation Sea Lion.
This is unprecedented. It's absolutely unprecedented.
They did the same thing in 9/11. They did the same thing on Sandy Hook. They bulldozed the thing and get rid of it as soon as possible to get rid of the evidence.
That's correct. And the images that I have, the forensic images I have of the Patty Bar and the Sorry Club site the following day are most likely the only ones in existence in the public domain. Because this was before they began the cleanup operation. So they apparently decided that they were going to make a clean sweep of this immediately, and there was a considerable amount of backlash from the Indonesian military and the national police over this procedure.
Right.
And they made multiple excuses, one citing traditional culture in that they immediately, you know, clean everything up and try to get back to everything back in balance again as soon as possible, and it just didn't hold any water. I mean, you don't have a bombing where, you know, hundreds of people are killed, and you know, just all of a sudden say, well, you know, wrap it up, let's wrap it up and clean it up, and that's going to be the end of it. And especially they went to the effort of dumping this in the ocean. You know, I mean, why would they do something like this? It just, you know, staggers the imagination that supposedly professionals would resort to this type of evidence destruction when they could have very easily, you know, removed. If it was that important for them to clean this site up to, you know, assuage cultural sensibilities, one would think that they would at least transport this evidence to a secure holding area on land where it could be sifted through even more. You know, even though it wasn't on site, which it should have been, you know, there's just no explanation as to why they would dump it in the ocean after what happened. You know,
we do have a question from Eddie Sugiarto in Irian Jaya, who asks, can you tell us what happened directly prior to your dismissal from Jakarta Post?
Yes. I printed the analysis, which I believe the USMC hadn't thought was going to happen. I found out later that the U.S. Ambassador Ralph Boyce had really raised the heat level up on the Jakarta Post to kill it before it even went to print. So after it was printed, there was a massive backlash just by virtue of the fact that it was printed in the first place, and then. For what it contained. And so right before I was dismissed, I found out from one of my students that the chief editor, Raymond Turan, had been meeting with U.S. Ambassador Ralph Boyce and discussing my investigation. You know, so, you know, we'd always wondered, you know, how these individuals had managed to always be one step ahead of us, and this was why. I was reporting to my chief editor.
There was an actual push to shut down all the newspapers reporting this.
That's correct. I mean, it was across the board, in broadcast and in print. And they started with the print media, Compass, and then it filtered out into the broadcast media, resulting in journalists from other media organizations actually calling me, the Jakarta Post, and inquiring as to not only the progress of our investigation, but what they should do now since they've been shut down. And this all culminated in a meeting about a week later of all the journalists from all these different media organizations here in Jakarta, both broadcast and print. And we conducted this meeting at the Jakarta Post, and this resulted in us combining our collective investigations. And these are some of the bravest individuals I've ever had the privilege of working with. These journalists were absolutely fearless, and they were determined to find out what happened, exactly what happened here, and even at the cost of their own jobs and their careers. So that this progressed. We continued to work together up until the time that I was fired.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, we have a fresh question from Frank in Kentucky. Do you think we'll ever get the U.S. government back from being under control of those that did the crime of 9/11?
Yes, I do. Because 9/11, regardless of how long it takes, the truth continues to slowly bleed out. And one of these days, one thing is a constant, is people always talk. It might be a year, 5 years, 10 years down the road, but somewhere down the line, there's going to be a comprehensive investigation reopened into 9/11. And I believe as soon as the individuals that are in possession of knowledge of exactly what happened, they will feel safe enough to actually come out and provide testimony as to their knowledge, their personal knowledge, is what went down. So, yes, right. I do eventually believe that the true story on 9/11 will come out.
Okay, we're running out of time here, so I'm going to have to whip through some of these questions. Mr. Finnegan, do you believe it's a coincidence that Bali Police Chief Amadi Pastika was trained in Canberra by the Australian Federal Police, and yet he asked the feds to come in and investigate the site? Do you think that's a coincidence?
No. I don't think it's a coincidence. I spoke with Amadi Pastika at one point, and my inquiries went nowhere, and I was greeted with hostility when I made my inquiries.
Well, you mean that they pulled an M16 rifle on you, didn't they?
No, nothing like that. But just by virtue of the fact that we were running parallel investigations, professionals normally, as professional courtesy, at least collaborate to some degree, even if it's a very minor degree. And I received no cooperation whatsoever when right. When I met with General Pastika.
We have a question from Winston. Okay.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
Right. We have a question from Winston Smith in Hawaii. Mr. Finnegan, are there any parallels between Bali and 9/11? Now, I know Bali happened 1 day, 1 month, and 1 year after 9/11, but are there any other coincidences or parallels?
The parallel would be the modus operandi of the cover-up, of the actual destruction of evidence.
Right.
There was a definite pattern that is parallel. Yeah, I would say definitely.
Fantastic. Thanks for the answer and the question. We have a question from Moses in Washington State. Do you believe the claims made by Major General Smedley D. Butler that war is a racket and corporations just use the military for their power?
Absolutely. And we see it. General Butler was absolutely correct, and we've seen it throughout since World War II, up in, at least World War II, up until today, and it continues now in Afghanistan and in Iraq and now in Syria. Absolutely.
Right,
the military-industrial complex is addicted to money and therefore is addicted to endless war. You know, so General Butler was absolutely correct in his contention that war is indeed a racket.
But you being a former military man, working for the U.S. Marines yourself, has your opinion changed over the years?
As far as what goes, Steve?
As far as believing that the military is just a pawn for the corporations.
Well, the military is a separate entity within itself. And its leadership waxes and wanes. Now, take for instance, now the Joint Chiefs of Staff are completely in the pocket of the Obama administration and the military-industrial complex, corporate. Like I said, they're addicted to money. George W. Bush invaded Iraq, he started a new generation, a new wave of militarization and the subsequent enrichment of the corporations through war, through endless war. And that's what we're seeing today. We're seeing a continuation of this, you know, and it's going to be up to the American people to put a stop to this. This won't be halted within the government or within the military leadership. It will have to be the American people that put an end to this.
Absolutely. Very, very, very good answer there, Mr. Finnegan, sir. We have a question from Earthplay in New Mexico who asks, Mr. Finnegan, do you think Hillary will clear this all up?
I doubt that very much. I'm not really well-versed in Hillary Clinton's record outside of her connections to the Wall Street bankers and their connection to the military-industrial complex. I don't think that Hillary Clinton, if she were by chance elected, would be compelled in any way, shape, or form to take on corporate America or the military-industrial complex. I simply don't believe that she would possess the power were she elected. You know, this
right.
is something that's across the board and eclipses the executive in D.C. It eclipses it. So if she were, or if the military-industrial complex believed that she was inclined to make any changes or to even make inquiries, that she would never be allowed on the ticket as a Democratic candidate.
We have a question from Winston Smith in Hawaii. Mr. Finnegan, are there any metal artifacts that could be analyzed still in existence from the Sari Club?
No, there's nothing. When I was allowed into the site on the morning following the bombing, it was under the condition that I was allowed to only take images and I was to touch nothing. Had I known at the time that the evidence was going to be shoveled up and dumped Mapanoa Harbor, I would have made every effort to secure physical evidence. But at the time, I was operating on the assumption that the investigation was going to, by the international investigation team, was going to be conducted professionally and to the letter. And we only found out much later that it was not, and that I made a serious mistake in assuming that it would be and not trying to gather evidence independently. This was one of the mistakes that I'll regret.
So in your opinion, the official investigation was just nothing more than a cover-up?
That's correct. It was nothing more than a cover-up by the international investigation team, by the Australian Federal Police and the FBI, and what other government entities were involved. I'm certain that the CIA was involved in this. And that the Indonesian military and the Indonesian authorities were taken for a ride. Absolutely, completely taken for a ride by these people. You know.
We got time for one last question, Mr. Finnegan. Do you support the stop funding of Israel?
Absolutely not. There's no reason militarily for any type of support from the United States. They're well in possession of a capable military, and they also are in possession of nuclear weapons. So there's no reason whatsoever for continued U.S. support of Israel, politically or militarily. And as a matter of fact, it's to the detriment of the United States to continue support of Israel. You know, just by virtue of the fact that it inflames sectarian and religious violence in the Middle East, and especially against Americans in general and innocent Americans, and especially American expatriates abroad.
Mm. And that money that they give to Israel certainly could be used to help support the veterans.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, the administration in power now in Washington, D.C., is completely and totally corrupt. Our veterans now are homeless and on the streets. You're aware of the VA scandal that's still boiling on the back burner in America. That's never been addressed, and it won't be addressed as long as Obama is still in power. Hopefully that the next individual that assumes the presidency will put this issue first and foremost on the front burner, because now we have... Okay.
You've been listening to the People Speak radio show with special guest Bob Finnegan. I'd like to thank him and to remind all the listeners to visit his website at thefifthestate.asia. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Robert S. Finnegan, sir.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
God bless. It's been great. Join us coming up soon. Thank you. Join us coming up soon on the People Speak show when I talk with Norwegian doctor Dr. Mads Gilbert from Gaza and Canadian YouTuber Peter Chow. Big thanks go out to the producers Mike, Doug, and Donald, to all my friends throughout the world, and to all the guys that give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel, but for me for now, take care and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.